TCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The Competition Commission says First Bus are profiteering in Bristol, so what's the City's Chair of Transport going to do about it? With rail fares just up by an average 9% at a time when our disposable incomes are shrinking fast, representing Rail Futures, BCFM presenter Steve Satan is here. After last week's revelation that MP for Filton and Bradley Stoke is a Freemason, we hear more from author Martin Short about what goes on in the secret Masonic temples at the bottom of Park Street and ask, might his Masonic membership compromise his work as an MP? And with the revolving doors between Scotland Yard and the Murdoch Empire, and Murdoch apparently dishing out get-out-of-jail-free cards, will criminality at News International be used by the Leveson inquiry to dodge charging Andy Coulson, Rebecca Brooks and Rupert and James Murdoch, and gag the entire press instead? Also, we zoom in on the relationship between police and the media with Professor Anthony J. Hall from Alberta, Canada, and ask, does Britain harbour dark forces obsessed with media lies and acquiring power by any means? With a sink poor but secret law, might is right. But first, I'm joined by BCFM presenter Steve Satan, who's here tonight representing Rail Futures. Hi, Steve, and
hi,
welcome to Drive Time. Now, first of all, what is Rail Futures?
Well, it's actually singular. And
Future?
Future, yeah, that's the name of our organisation. And it's a campaign that basically we just want a better deal for rail. We want cheaper fares, we want reopened lines, we want more freight on railway, all the sort of stuff that that no one could really argue with.
But Tim is our Chair of Transport, hasn't heard about you. So are you a very small organisation?
Well, no, we're a national organisation. I don't just appear on BCFM. You'll hear me cropping up on Five Live and various other radio stations around the country from time to time. So I think Tim needs to sort of listen to the radio a bit more. I don't know. I mean, you know, any organisation that's run by volunteers, you know, we're a campaigning group, and I do my best, but we can't afford the.
So are you actually funded by any kind of interest group?
No, not at all. No, we're totally independent.
And what would you like to see in Bristol? Obviously your focus is on rail, and we've got the Chair of Transport here, so what do you want to tell Tim?
Well, where do we start? There's so much that needs doing, and I suppose if I reel off a list of things that I think need doing, they won't come as any surprise to Tim. But I suppose what's frustrating is that they always seem to get down the bottom of the list. And with the money that's been wasted on the Bristol Link Road or this stupid bus rapid transit, we could easily reopen Portishead, we could open Saltford, we could have the Henbury Loop running, and so on. And the spending priorities just seem to be completely insane.
You've said there the stupid bus rapid transit. Mm. The idea of bus rapid transit sounds like quite a good idea. Tim, can you just explain what it is?
Well, bus rapid transit is basically a bit of a super bus. It's a sort of mixture between bus and tram, but more bus. It's a faster, more direct routes, using in certain areas guideways and bus priorities. And basically, we will be able to cut journey times on routes a lot more. We'll have more frequent services and have higher capacities. And we're going to link South Bristol in particular with North Bristol. I mean, we are projecting passenger numbers of around 8-9 million a year. That's quite a significant amount of passenger journeys.
So when is this going to happen? Because we keep hearing about these various different schemes. They never seem to materialise.
Well, we put in bids to government, and this is an important thing. Government set the criteria, we bid for the money. Our schemes, these schemes, and really at this point only these schemes, we had the business cases to get the money. We won the money for all five schemes for the West of England, which I've got to say everyone for the last 6 months have been telling me we wouldn't do. Well, we've done it. We've got every single scheme, we've got the funding for it. We're starting on it now. First one opens in 2015, and then the rest open 2016-2017.
Now, Steve, sounds to me as if something's actually moving on public transport at last in Bristol. Mm. Why do you call it stupid?
They're sham trams. They're basically glorified buses. And what politicians don't understand is this, that buses and trains and trams are not equivalent. So what politicians do, they say, well, look, we need to get people from A to B. We could have a train, or we could have a tram, or we could have a bus, or a glorified bus, bus rapid transit. And they regard them as equivalent, and they're not. And we have almost 50 years of experience that that buses are not as effective as trams and trains at attracting people out of their cars. So-called bustitution doesn't work. We have to go back to Beeching to see this. You know, when Beeching started closing these rail lines, it was a requirement.
This is in the 1960s.
In the 1960s, it was a requirement that there was an equivalent bus service to sort of replace the rail service, and everyone would be happy, wouldn't they? No, of course not, because the bus service just withered and died because people didn't use the bus instead of the train. They abandoned the train and they all bought cars and started using their cars. And despite, you know, the overwhelming evidence that it doesn't work, people still waste money on these stupid girly buses. And we have to look at the Cambridge fiasco to see what a ridiculous
idea. Okay, so what happened in Cambridge? Let's tell us about that, because that may be a lesson, Tim, for us here.
Mm. Well, I've got another lesson as well, actually. The Cambridge lesson first, and we'll go to the French one. The Cambridge lesson is that there's a railway line, disused railway line, going out of Cambridge towards, I can't remember, St Ives, isn't it? Yeah, mm. And there was a campaign to reopen the rail line, and it would have cost 60 million or something. And instead of reopening the rail line, despite overwhelming public support for reopening the rail line, the county council said, no, we're going to rip up the rail line, we're going to put this guided bus in instead. And it cost twice as much, it was 2 years late, and it's a turkey. It works, okay, it works, it gets you from Cambridge to St Ives, but it's no better than the existing bus on the A14, and it's wasted £180 million of public money. And the same is going to happen in Bristol with these bus rapid transits. They don't work. It's a waste of money.
That's only half the Cambridge story. And the week it opened, it had so many passengers, the two companies that run the buses on there have already ordered more buses. It is over capacity already. It's one of the biggest successes in public transport in years. The same companies that built the Cambridge bus rapid transit, and clearly a mistake happened in its construction. I don't dispute with you there at all. It was a massive mistake. Have also built the new Gosport Hampshire route on time, on budget. Bus rapid transit offers a cheap solution to deliver significant public transport improvements. I accept they are different to tram and train. They do not attract the same amount of passengers as a tram or train. A tram would attract at least 5% more passengers simply just being a tram. We realise that. We actually work that into our business cases. There's a significant difference in cost in delivery. To deliver what I want to deliver via tram would actually cost close to £1 billion.
Tim, can you just tell us what one of these bus rapid transit systems looks like? What do they look like? I mean, does it look like a bus? Does it look like a tram?
They can look like anything. I mean, this is the thing. You don't need to get caught up on the bus. You can use a normal bus, or you can use an articulated vehicle, which looks a bit like a tram. Often people call them bendy buses. It'd be like a posh bendy bus. You can choose any type of vehicle to use. There are advantages and disadvantages with different sorts of vehicles. The key thing is what they have is they have less frequent stops, a bit more like a tram or a train. They're about every 800 metres. You have automated systems of ticketing, no paying the driver. So you're on and off the bus very quickly. Key problem with buses, they lose way too much time at bus stops.
So they're actually just using the road in a normal way, like a normal bus would?
They can use the road just as a normal bus, or a bus lane just as a bus. They have priority measures at street lights just as normal buses do. But the other thing that we can do with our bus rapid transit, and we are doing on certain parts of our lines, we're going to put them on guided bus routes. So these will be on special dedicated guided bus routes, and on these the driver doesn't steer, the bus is actually steered.
Now Steve, this sounds great, doesn't it?
It works, but it's still a bus, and it's still perceived as a bus. And you have to ask, let me give you the other example I was going to bring as well. There's a number of guided bus systems around Europe. They've been around for years, and it's significant that they haven't taken off. You know, the world is not awash with guided bus. In many places they've been abandoned, and just very recently, just this last week, it's been announced that the system in Caen in northern France has been abandoned. They're going to replace it with a proper light rail system, because they realise that, you know, these sham trams aren't a replacement. They're not equivalent and they don't do the job, and the only way we're going to get decent public transport is with steel on steel, I'm afraid.
But another part of France, and I've got to be honest, I can't remember the city, but I've got it back in my office, where they've already got tram and they've got three tram routes. They've actually built the fourth via bus. Now that's interesting, they've gone for bus rapid transit. It's taken off very big in North America, actually comes out of South America in particular, the BRT concept. It is taking off. I don't necessarily
think... No, I disagree
think.
With that. It isn't taking off. Why are the vast majority of public transport systems in Europe, they're steel wheel, steel on steel, rail transport, because they know it works. And you don't have to be a genius to realise that public transport in mainland Europe is so much better than it is in this country.
I think the key thing is, it doesn't mean we rule out trams for Bristol. I mean, quite the opposite. I'm very keen that we do bring tram concepts to Bristol.
So why are we wasting time and wasting money with this halfway house that we know we're going to have to get rid of in the future?
We're not wasting time and we're not wasting money. It will deliver real benefits. It's something we can afford to do now. And a key thing we've got to work with government is to get down the construction costs of tram in this country. We need to explain, why does it cost 30% plus more to build a tram system in Britain than it does in France? French trams are not unsafe. So why is that built into the way we actually build our systems?
One of the other big differences between Britain and the continent is, this is from the I newspaper earlier on this week, and commuters feel the January fare rise pinch. This is this roughly 9%, 10% increase that we've just had in the cost of rail fares. The pressure group Campaign for Better Transport claims the increases make the UK's public transport yet more unaffordable compared to European competitors. Last week it said some rail passengers across the Channel pay 10 times less for annual season tickets on equivalent routes around about a bit more, between 20 and 30 miles. Well, why are people in Britain paying 10 times more than the people on the continent for the same kind of journey?
Well, they pay higher taxes, so you get higher state subsidy, and it's just a simple matter of choice. An interesting article I just read today on the BBC was the actual average cost of travelling by rail per mile is 20 pence a mile is the average cost, and obviously you've got massive differences within that average cost. And back in the 1960s...
Sorry, you're talking about the rail fares, the ticket price, or the industry cost?
The ticket price. Right. And back in the 1960s, once you actually, of course, change for inflation and type of coin, it was 20p a mile.
Right. So you're saying, I mean, that's right. It is true that our rail fares are actually the highest in Europe. They're not amongst the highest in Europe. It's a myth that we have the highest petrol in Europe, but it's true that we have the highest rail fares. And we have the highest industry costs as well. And you have to blame privatisation for this. Privatisation has introduced a huge amount of complexity into the system, which involves contracts and lawyers and so on.
Shareholders, doesn't it?
Yes.
We're paying off.
Although I think that's actually a relatively small proportion of the problem. It's more the integration that causes the problem. And
it's complex fares as well. Actually, the fare structure is the most complicated in Europe, the British fare structure. You can get very cheap rail tickets. You also get exceptionally expensive rail tickets. And the big problem, I think, for rail users is actually knowing what is the cheapest fare. Why do we have this pricing structure? And I think it's blown out of all proportion.
But at the end of the day, Tim, the oil companies are laughing, aren't they? Because as our public transport, which by the way does include taxis, and the taxi drivers at Templemeads are all extremely annoyed that they're now being charged hundreds of pounds a year, it looks like, from April, to actually even pull up to Templemeads station to take people. This is our public transport, and this is again First Group cashing in on the fact that they can actually put a new tax on our taxi drivers. The oil companies are just laughing at us, aren't they? Because our public transport is a total mess.
I think what's interesting, though, is that oil companies know that their time is limited. You do increasingly see oil companies investing in green technologies. Are they doing that because they really love the planet? Well, I don't think so. If you work in oil, you're in the business for making money. And they realise long-term their time is limited. And I think this is really important. We must change the British economy away from oil. Even if you're one of the few people in this country who doesn't believe in global warming, you must believe that the economy of this country and actually its future security is important. And you're not going to get that unless we get away from being reliant on oil.
But can you actually see that? Because we're now in a situation where we've got something like 25 million vehicles on our roads. That's one for every other person, including children. Actually, the oil companies are just laughing in our faces, aren't they? Because they can see that as our public transport, as various things make it more and more expensive, it started really with this, as Steve was saying, with beaching in the 1960s, whacking up the... actually, it was done under a Conservative Conservative government under a transport minister, Ernest Marples, who also had his own company, Marples Ridgeway, who built motorways. And he decided that he was going to actually help his own company by closing down the railways and introducing a motorway building programme. Now, all this just plays into the hands of the ruthless oil companies.
Well, but the current government is investing in public transport infrastructure, and I think that is really important. I want them to invest even more in public transport infrastructure, and whenever I meet with a government minister or anyone I think even knows the government minister, that's the key thing I'm going to be saying to them. And actually, if we want the British economy to grow and grow in a sustainable way, that's the most important thing they can be doing over the next 10 years.
On the subject of oil, of course, how does your sham tram bus rapid transit run? It runs on
biomethane.
Oil. Okay.
And that's oil. That's biomethane produced here in Bristol.
And that's unsustainable, isn't it? There is the biofuels thing is a huge con, because there simply is nowhere near enough bio in the world to run our economy in the same way.
Well, one of the arguments, Tim,
produced from our own waste.
Well, Tim, one of the arguments used against that kind of biofuel is that it's actually taking over areas in agricultural areas in other countries. So can you just answer that one?
This is biomethane produced from our own waste, so our food waste. We're creating a biomethane plant here to process that. We're going to have a lot of fuel coming out the other end. We want to put it on our buses.
Okay, that's great, but it's not sustainable for the economy as a whole. There isn't enough. I'm a big believer in peak oil, and I think the price of oil over the next few years is going to just go absolutely through the roof. And so it's very welcome that we've had the electrification of...
Well, we had a little threat of that, didn't we, at the weekend, with the Iranians threatening to close the Straits of Hormuz. And also all these hedge fund managers and derivatives people thinking, well, maybe we should bet on the oil price doubling in the next week and we'll make a fortune. Now, this is all gambling, surely, Tim, with our transport for the future, and it's really not a very sensible way of doing things. If we had a decent public transport in the city, which at the moment we don't, then people would actually be able to give up their cars and maybe not completely give them up, but start using public transport to commute into work. So how can you convince us that that's going to happen?
Well, bus rapid transit is just phase one. I don't want people to think that's our only game in town. I mean, we're going to be making some announcements beginning of next week regarding transport, some significant investments, definitely some additional investment in rail.
Good.
From the city council, and we'll be revealing more probably Monday, Tuesday, and a lot of people will hear about what we're talking about.
How have your attempts to get more rail in the past gone, and you know, have they been successful?
They have. I mean, one thing we've done is let's take a look at the Severn Beach line. So 10 years ago, basically, they were going to close the line.
It's a bit of a grim line, isn't it? And in fact, if you go to Severn Beach, it's a bit of a grim place. It seems sort of abandoned and cold, and not much of a beach at all. But having said that, apparently it's been a bit of a success story. So tell us about that.
Well, it's a massive success story. In the last 5-6 years, we've seen growth on the line of over 90%. Every year, we're seeing 10-20% plus growth. I mean, it's very significant growth. And it's the second highest growth in the whole of the franchise. For first, have given us the figures. They themselves talk a lot about that line. Now, why has that occurred? That's because the city council invested in the line, upped the service. Key thing we want to do is improve that service even more. We've already announced we're going to deliver another station. We're going to build a platform at Portway Park and Ride. It's going to be the first new platform or station here in the Bristol area for decades.
That's good news, isn't it?
Well, I absolutely agree, but it just proves my point that where you invest in rail, it's very successful. It's very successful at attracting passengers. I guarantee that the sham tram bendy bus won't be as successful.
But the bus rapid transit goes to places where rail doesn't even exist. One thing we to get to rail companies.
Like Portishead or
Hartcliffe
or Henbury. I mean, there's
you can't have a rail line into Hartcliffe, can you? You've got to have a bus, some sort of bus type thing.
Well, you can have a light rail that uses existing roads, has tracks laid in
like a tram or something.
Like a tram, that's what I'm trying to say, yeah. But I mean, there are places, I mentioned Henbury, that Portishead, where the rail lines exist, where we could put on a service and it would be successful. And similarly, of course, we've got the cycle track as well. Why don't we reopen the rail line there? That'd be a good investment.
I'm glad you mentioned the Portishead line. We're massive supporters of the Portishead line, and I'm determined we will get that reopened. What we need, we've already put in one bid to government. Personally, I don't think that bid was good enough. I think we need to relook at that. We need to put more stations on it, opening up, oomph it up, and get that delivered. We need network rails plan for reopening.
But Tim, I mean, we've had a look at the Severn Beach. That's been a massive success, and yet the operators first group had to be really kicked into doing it, even though it was a successful thing. Why are we having to wait for the whole Portishead thing? Surely they can, yeah, they're sensible people. They can see, well, this has worked for Severn Beach. Maybe it could work for Portishead.
Well, the way this whole rail system works is that First, as an operator, spends very little on actual infrastructure. That's more done by Network Rail via the Department of Transport, and they have these plans, and they're just now working out their next 5-year plan. Over the next sort of 6 months, they're working that up. The key demand we're actually making to them here at the moment, and this is essential, is four tracking. It sounds the most boring thing on earth, but between Bristol, Temple Meads and Filton Banks, one of the great choke points of the British rail system. Our problem is we can't get more local rail services because that choke point basically knocks most of them out. What we need to do is turn that from two tracks to four tracks. The biggest argument we need to win with Network Rail, and I've got to say, they believe it as well, we've got to make sure, we've got to keep saying it to them, to the Department of Transport, is we need four tracking. We get that, we can start to radically change our rail offer here in this part of the country.
Now, Steve, sounds like you've got a bit of an advocate in the council.
Well, no, obviously, I don't disagree with everything Tim says, and he's absolutely right about the four-tracking. There, across the rail network, there is a real problem with capacity. And, you know, some very short-sighted moves in the sort of 60s and 70s to shut lines and to economise. So there's these four tracks that go north out of Bristol, and they've been reduced to two. And anyone driving taking the train through Stapleton Road and Filton on the Severn Beach Line can see where these two tracks were. And I thought it was the case that that's sort of part of the deal with electrification, that we get the four tracking, because I think it's pretty essential, really. But I'm all in favour.
Steve, tell us about your show you do here on BCFM, and also about your whereabouts do we find Rail Future on the internet?
Well, Rail Future, it's pretty easy to find. You just type in Rail Future, all one word, into your favourite search engine. It's railfuture.org.uk. As I said, we're an independent campaign group. We just campaign for a better rail, cheaper fares, reopen lines, more freight on railway. Who could disagree with that? And Steve Satan can be heard on BCFM Monday lunchtimes and Thursday lunchtimes between 12 and 2.
Lovely. And Tim, can you just wind up by telling us what you're doing about this competition commission, because we hear that they're looking into bus competition and saying Bristol is one of the cities where they're saying there is nowhere near enough competition here.
Well, I wrote into the competition commission and put a submission in and said this is a real issue for us. Ticketing is a real issue, particularly cross operator ticketing. We needed more powers around that. I'm really pleased with the report they've come back. One key thing which I'm going to be seeing for the next few months to my other colleagues in authorities around me and to the various companies, including First, is we need to deliver a ticket which works across all the operators, a day ticket people can use. We need that on a smart card. And one way we could do that is to form a company together and make that an affordable ticket. And I think that will be a key element to delivering a better and more flexible bus service which works for the public here in Bristol.
Well, that sounds great, but the showcase bus route that have gone in, particularly this one in Fishponds, has come up with it. There's been a lot of criticism of it, and after a Freedom of Information request, there was the Evening Post printed some information saying, this is back in October this year, last year, 2011, saying that the police are very worried about your, well, the police don't call them this, but a lot of the local people do, the bonkers bus stops that have been moved out into the middle of the road, so that the buses stop on Fishponds Road now and various other places in the city, right out in the middle of the road. So if anyone wants to overtake a bus, they have to actually drive or cycle right into the path of oncoming traffic. Now, not surprising, is it really, that the police are saying that this is a potential safety risk? Well, it is a real safety risk, particularly for cyclists.
Well, the police aren't saying that. One police officer did write in to say, you know, some concerns have been raised. He thought there was a point to it. We took a look at that. We investigated that. We went back to the police with a report on safety on the bus stops, and they said, hey, you're right, they're not a risk.
Well, they are a risk, aren't they? If you're a cyclist and you're having to pull out round a bus to get past a bus because the bus has been sitting there, you know, for half a minute, 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, picking up passengers, picking up fares, you're forcing cyclists into the path of oncoming traffic. How can that be possibly safe?
Well, the reason these bus stops have been constructed are for multiple reasons. The main reason was to protect parking. There was a lot of residents parking there. For a bus to profile in and dock to a stop correctly would have involved the removal of a lot of residential parking there. So those who are campaigning against these bus stops, what they must realise is what they're actually campaigning for is the removal of all the car parking along the road. That's the flip side they need to think about. When a bus stops at the bus stop, yes, for the short period it's there, traffic is held up. But what we've done is we've sped up the whole of the Fishponds Road. So actually, from start to end, your journey is faster, whether the bus stops or not. One of the key things, what I think we do need to make sure we deliver this year, is ticketless boarding, I mean, in particular, smart cards. So that bus is not stopped there for 3 or 4 minutes loading passengers. Actually, the bus should be stopped there for less than 60 seconds. This is the key to making buses more attractive to people. They need to get to their destinations faster. The best way to gain back time is to reduce the time the bus takes to load and unload passengers.
Now, they're also saying that this is just this week in the Evening Post that passengers on the Bristol's buses could be soon be playing with credit cards. Is that because the fares are so expensive that they can't afford them, they need to put them on their credit card?
Certainly Bristol's fares are not the cheapest, but we've done a bit of a study into this, and really first fares are about average compared to other cities. A few years ago we were the most expensive. What's happened is they've frozen their day tickets here in Bristol, whereas other cities we've seen those prices increase.
Okay.
So we're around average. I think one key thing what we do need though is faster boarding. That's all about trying to remove the need to pay the driver and about having automated systems.
But what are you doing about this business that the Competition Commission is so concerned about, where people in Bristol are paying far too much for their bus travel?
Well, this is the key thing about delivering a cross ticket, which will have a price agreed with the councils. Till now, we've had no powers to do this. What the government is now talking about is giving us some powers over this, including ticket prices. And that's something we're going to be exploring with the bus companies. And what we're going to be challenging them is, come together with us voluntarily. If you don't choose to do that, we'll take those powers on offer from the government and we'll force you to the table. It'll be in their interests to come to us voluntarily.
Tough talk from Tim Kent, who's Liberal Democrat councillor and also in charge of transport at the Bristol City Council Cabinet.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
So, after last week's revelations that MP for Bristol and Bradley Stoke is a Freemason, that's Jack Lopresti, we hear from author Martin Short about what goes on in the two secret Masonic temples at the bottom of Park Street. I put it to Martin when I spoke to him a few weeks ago that Freemasonry was really just like a golf club.
There is a lot of religiosity in the rituals. I mean, it might be fairer to say that they're a kind of cult. Freemasonry is a kind of, you're either kind of sort of highest common factor or lowest common denominator. I mean, it plucks in this sort of 17th century phantasmagoria, pulled together different elements, some Judaic, some Christian, some kind of barbarian, all thrown in together in the myth of the erection of the Temple of Solomon. The funny thing is that though it's all meant to be about the secrets of the construction of this stone temple by the Mason Hiram Abiff, if you look in the Bible, the only reference to the Temple of Solomon shows that it was actually made out of wood. So you wouldn't need a stonemason. So the entire basis of Freemasonry is based upon a palpable invention. Now, in among all this, and particularly as you go up the so-called Scottish Rite or the Rose Choir to 33 degrees, it's more and more religious. I mean, much is made of the fact, you know, Rudyard Kipling and his lodge in India, you know, that it was ecumenical. People from any religion could join. You know, Christian, Muslim, Jew, Sikh, you know, Zoroastrian, anyway. Anyone who believed in a single god, you see, the only stipulation was it should be monotheistic. But once you get above the third degree, it's all Christian. It's all Christian in a kind of perverse form. It's all fictive. It's all a miasma of legend and lies, you know. And sadly, I actually think of it's like a pyramid sales operation, Freemasonry, because you have to keep on going up all these ranks in the hope that one day you will find the secret, the absolute kernel secret of Freemasonry. But as we've seen, they change the actual, you know, magic words. You know, the words that you're told up to a certain level are the secret words sides of Freemasonry. You're told, oh, no, it's not like that at all. You know, you've been led down the garden path. I mean, it is a bit like a pyramid sales operation. And, of course, it does cost you a huge amount of money, because with each different order you join, whether it's the Knight Templars or the Arc Mariners or the Rose Choir, you have to buy another set of aprons and a whole lot of gear. You know, I mean, it's a big business here. So for all this talk about giving money to the lifeboats and helping sick children and, you know, all this kind of, you know, helping, you know, with the education of dead Freemasons, the children, every Freemason has to spend more money than we'll ever get back from this outfit.
That was Martin Short speaking to me a few weeks ago. He's the author of Inside the Brotherhood, which is still in print. Great thick book, an expose of Freemasonry, and also a six-part Granada TV documentary that was broadcast in 1989. Now, in the 1980s, there was a big Masonic corruption scandal exposed by Paul Foote at the Daily Mirror and in private eye. As part of Inside the Brotherhood, that six-part documentary I was telling you about, Granada TV went out onto the streets of Southend and asked members of the public what they knew about Freemasonry.
It's like a lodge, isn't it, where people go, you know, you want to get on a bit, you're a Freemason, aren't you, and you're Masonics.
Well, they're all over the place down here, everywhere you go.
Brother speaks for brother, don't they?
Yes. Secret society, yeah.
They shake hands.
They're so secret, we don't know what they do.
Yeah, they do. They stick they've to got a
special,
another, don't they?
Yes, they've got a special handshake. They wear silly leather pinnies and no secret society. Probably fairly powerful, I should imagine. There's a lot of very wealthy people about here that are very interested in doing that sort of thing.
Bunch of bastards. To a man. The firm I work for is mainly run by Masons. Unfortunately, that led to a lot of people who aren't particularly good at their job getting into influential places.
What sort of firm do you work in?
I wouldn't like to say, especially on camera. But you know who you are, don't you?
That was an extract from Martin Short's documentary for Granada TV, Inside the Brotherhood, which was broadcast in 1989. Next, we'll have more on Freemasonry from author of the book, that is the same book, Inside the Brotherhood, and the six-part Granada TV documentary. All this is available online. As well, you'll find links to these links on our website, that is at thisweek.org.uk, or else you can go to the main BCFM website at bcfm.org.uk. And if you have access to an up-to-date Masonic Provincial Yearbook for Bristol, please do drop it in at the station here, and I'll be happy to return it if you wish. And more from that and on that particular topic next week.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Now, what with the revolving doors between Scotland Yard and the Murdoch Empire, with Murdoch's apparently dishing out get-out-of-jail-free cards to his staff, will criminality at News International be used by the Leveson Inquiry to dodge charging Andy Coulson, Rebecca Brooks and Rupert and James Murdoch and gag the entire press instead? We zoom in now on the relationship between the police and the media with author of Earth into Property, Professor Anthony J. Hall from Alberta, Canada.
I'm Anthony Hall. I come from Alberta, Canada. My book, Earth into Property, Colonization, Decolonization, and Capitalism, came out recently. The Independent in the UK here chose it as one of the best books of 2010 in their Christmas picks list.
Now, colonization and colonial powers is quite a big topic at the moment, isn't it? Particularly with the expansion of what appears to be the US empire. How do you think that's all going? And would you say it's an American empire, a bit like the old British empire used to be?
Well, of course, the United States emerges from the British empire. The United States emerges from a civil war within the British Empire, the secessionist movement that decided they could control this process of westward expansion themselves rather than be a kind of sub-empire, an empire within the British Empire. So the lands on which the United States sit, of course, they were the lands of indigenous peoples, many aboriginal groups, nations, but those lands in prior to the existence of the United States had been colonized by Spain, by France, by the Netherlands, Russia in the case of Alaska, and of course Great Britain. So that history, I think, figures prominently after World War II, when the colonial empires of Europe are exhausted, can't hold on to their colonial holdings, and the United States kind of moves into that vacuum of power with instruments of informal empire, laissez-faire empire, where the colonial office in Great Britain had governed colonies according to, you know, laws, protocols. The Pentagon, in a way, is like the new colonial office, but the means of governance are covert. It's not written down, but through regime change, through covert tactics, sometimes through outright military aggressions. This Pentagon-based empire is an informal empire. You know, there's no written statutes that describe, for instance, how the United States will rule, say, Saudi Arabia, or rule Honduras or Guatemala or the Central American polities. But we know, nevertheless, that all roads lead to Washington, that this is the core of an informal empire. So the formal empire of Great Britain was more or less taken over by the informal empire of the United States. Of course, the United States did have some formal colonies. Philippines was actually treated as a U.S. colony after 1898, the Spanish-American War. Hawaii was colonized. And really, if you think about the Western expansion of the United States, which is what I very much focus on in Earth into Property, that is an imperial expansion. That is an ingestion of new territories, a removal of indigenous peoples, sometimes eliminated, sometimes put in small enclaves called reservations. So this earlier period where the United States incorporates territories that had been colonized by France, Spain, Britain, you could see that as a preparation for the new phase of imperialism, of informal empire, laissez-faire empire. Now, of course, much of this was justified during the Cold War in the name of a battle against communism. So in order to justify, say, the 700 U.S. military bases around the world, in order to justify the militarization of space, in order to justify submarines, Trident submarines that carry great packages of nuclear weapons, all of this was promoted with the idea that, well, we're opposing communism and the Soviet Empire, and we're standing up for freedom and God-fearing society against the atheist, materialist empire, Stalinist empire, Marxist empire based in the Soviet Union. But after the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, after the demise of this polity, the Soviet Union, how would the United States justify its military presence and covert tactics through instruments like the CIA? How would they justify the continuation of this permanent war economy? And I think the evidence is overwhelming that the United States played a major role in inventing its own enemy. The fraudulent interpretation of 9/11 was clearly constructed in such a way that it made Arab people into a category of enemies, Muslim people into a category of enemies. It seems that the government of Israel, the right-wing Likudnik faction in Israel, had an agenda to make its enemies, its local enemies in its own neighborhood, into the enemies of the West. So this imperial structure, this Anglo-American imperial structure, now with Israel playing a prominent role, the global war on terror has given it a justification. The old patriarchy, the old elites, the patrons of the Cold War, of the capitalist side of the Cold War, because of the events of 9/11 and the subsequent global war on terror, they held their positions and they got new sources of funding, new sources of patronage. Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, you know, if it hadn't been for 9/11, would have been obsolete, would have been outmolded Cold Warriors. But suddenly 9/11, in which both of them seem to be quite involved, you know, Cheney in the bunker on the morning of the 9/11, running the whole military system while the official head of state, George Bush, is pulled off into Florida, he's pulled off into the Midwest. I mean, Dick Cheney, there's an example of a person who embodies this military-industrial complex. Formerly, he is the president of Halliburton, a company that sort of combines big oil with the logistical needs of the U.S. Armed Forces. You know, he was president of that company, CEO and chairman of the board from 1995 to 2000. So he goes back to 1975 when he was brought in as Gerald Ford's primary secretary, the head of his office. So there is a person who is right at the very nexus where this huge channeling of federal funds to the military-industrial complex, to the world's largest corporate entities. He was right there at that locus where the private companies meet the public governance in the structure of the military-industrial complex. So, of course, we're seeing a period where the U.S. is going down. It's going down quickly. It doesn't have the financial power now to sustain these 700 bases, this militarization of space. And 9/11 was also a kind of sleight of hand that caused us to sort of look away, and it created a context where these games, where the executive branches of these corporations, they were kleptocrats, able to steal from the shareholders.
But yeah, hang on, you're saying we were told to look away, but it was all there, on live on television.
Yes, look away towards what's going on with the Twin Towers, the demise of the Twin Towers, what happened on the Pentagon. Look at the television to see all these pictures of Arabs and Muslims who are jihadists and diabolical figures planning terrible deeds in caves in Afghanistan. Meanwhile, we're looking away from Wall Street, what actually happens in Wall Street. You know, it's a diversionary tactic which gives the thieves and kleptocrats at the top levels of these corporate entities a lot of latitude to steal. When we talk about the history of this westward expansion, the appropriation of lands and resources from indigenous peoples, I mean, that's a key to understanding empire, understanding imperialism. But now it's as if the financial apparatus has turned on the middle class. It's a kleptocracy taking wealth from families, from the middle classes. And you know, we're seeing a continuation of a great concentration of wealth and a dispossession and disempowerment of the vast majority of peoples.
So isn't America going to self-destruct if there is no middle class? Surely the U.S. electorate will simply kick these people out because they're not delivering the goods in regards to quality of life and wealth.
Well, that's if we had an electoral system that worked, and that's if we had people in the media who would interpret things as they are. But instead, we have a mainstream media that is basically engaged in lies and diversionary tactics that perpetuates the big lie of 9/11, for instance. I mean, 9/11 isn't just a story. It establishes the framework for the news every day. And, you know, as we're told that we must be petrified of Islamic fundamentalists, jihadists, that this is the biggest problem we face. You know,
are you saying that there isn't a problem with Islamic terrorism then?
I'm saying that we've seen through the Cold War secret state working with any type of theocrat. I mean, during the Cold War, you had an atheist. Marx said, you know, religion is the opiate of the people. Anybody who has a theocratic agenda is automatically anti-communist. And we know that the secret state financed Islamic fundamentalists, not only Islamic, but any religion, every religion. So we know that Al-Qaeda, for instance, emerges from within the national security state. It's financed and organized by the CIA through the ISI in Pakistan. So the Al-Qaeda isn't some external enemy. It's not something out there. It's a creation from within the national security state. So are we to believe, for instance, that Osama bin Laden sort of handed in his resignation? He's a CIA agent. One day he says, oh, I'm not a CIA agent anymore. I'm going off with my brothers in caves in Afghanistan, and we're going to plan to attack the military-industrial complex, the most elaborate military apparatus the world has ever seen. We'll get through that, and we'll do it independently. As I was working on this paper, I found myself coming up with this phrase, enemy alien. And in the early 20th century, J. Edgar Hoover was hired by the Justice Department to deal with enemy aliens. There was the Red Scare, there was the Palmerston Raids. We've got any enemy alien tended to be a short form for communist Jews from Eastern Europe who were seen to be, you know, threatening and perverting the American way of life. So we've been sold this idea that there's an enemy alien, that this Al-Qaeda, and they may be in our midst, but they're not us, they're different from us, they're alien from us. No doubt there are people who hate the West, they hate Christendom, but these can be...
Or the Bush version of Christendom.
But these can be transformed into assets. They're very valuable. So in false flag terrorism, for instance, we're living in a privatized terror economy where you need certain episodes. You need to generate fear. Fear can be very lucrative. You can sell foreign wars if you get people afraid enough. You can, companies like Blackwater can sell their mercenary services, not only to governments, but to corporations. So you need to generate a political environment where people are afraid of violent episodes in their midst.
Isn't that worrying in itself when you're talking about Blackwater there? Because clearly the big corporations have far more spending power nowadays than governments do.
Yeah, I mean, governments these days are pretty much storefront operations. That we saw this in the Rupert Murdoch News of the World. We're just looking at the very early entry point of this. But basically, that shows that police and media are the real government. They're the same. They work together. They collaborate. And by and large, elected officials and politics, as we understand it, the people who are engaged in that are playing bit parts written for them. They're bit players. Now, as the police and the media, we talk about phone hacking and whatnot, but we know that the police go up and up and up. I mean, the CIA, the MI5, the MI6, these are people with police powers. And so the collaboration between the media and the police, where it's decided, you know, who are the enemies, who are our friends, you know, this goes on all the time. And our legislatures and parliaments are basically like soap operas. They give us a little bit of drama, but the people seeking public office or who get public office, they're simply sort of reading from the script, the latitude of what they can talk about, what will be considered viable, popular. Somebody is deciding that, the spin doctors, those in charge of the psychological operations. And, you know, we live in a society that has invested a huge amount of resources in advertising, in, well, we call it public relations. Edward Bernays, he wrote a book called Propaganda, the sort of grand thinker of how you influence public opinion and how you create consent. Joseph Goebbels liked his book Propaganda, and of course in Germany they actually called what Goebbels' ministry was doing propaganda, so he came up with this term public relations. Public relations agencies sell us wars. I mean, they may sell us toothpaste, they may sell us presidents or prime ministers, but we know Hill and Knowlton, for instance, to deal with Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, that a whole psychological operation was created whereby a Kuwaiti woman said, oh my God, I was in the Iraqi hospitals and they were taking babies out of incubators and crashing the babies down and killing the babies. This was all an act to turn public opinion against the regime of Saddam Hussein, so you could invade, so you could attack. So this is a great tragedy of our time, that we can't believe the BBC. We can't believe so many of these instruments that are supposed to inform us and keep our democracies viable. They are taking their orders from public relations agencies. They are spinning us. They are going along with plans that are invented in this collaboration between the media and the police. Now, does it end with Rupert Murdoch, or is there a higher level who is giving orders on how to spin people's consciousness? So we live in a time where the big pollution we're dealing with is the pollution of the mental environment, the engineering of psychological conditions which facilitate invasions. Like when you think, you know, sending drones into Pakistan to attack whole communities, well, how is that possible that society allows that to happen on our behalf? We even are asked to pay for this. It can only happen if on some level we've dehumanized those people on the receiving end of the drone attacks, of the white phosphorus attacks, of the depleted uranium attacks. If we've somehow been sold a line that these are not really fully human people, they're kind of terrorist people, or their families are inclined to terrorism, or their religion is inclined to terrorism. You know, we've seen this dehumanization of populations in preparation for terrible things. We saw this in the Second World War. We saw this in Nazi Germany, where whole populations, gypsies, Jews, were depicted in the media as sort of subhuman, as scum. So when, you know, the concentration camps, when the full murder campaigns are underway, the surrounding population are willing to accept it and be complicit in it and even be involved in it. So we're seeing that with the poisoning of consciousness towards Arab people and, of course, the larger community of Islamic people. Incredibly to me, we living in the 21st century, who would have imagined that we live in a time where religious wars are being sort of sold to us? And we know on the right wing in the Bush years, Christian Zionists, the born-again Christians, you know, they tended to see the invasion of Iraq as an invasion of an infidel society. It was sold as a religious mission. And it goes back to very old themes in imperialism. I mean, imperialism doesn't say, well, we're going to appropriate resources so we can benefit a minority in the imperial capitals. You don't put it that way. You say, no, we're bringing civilization to the savages. We're bringing Christianity to the infidels. We're bringing the universal Roman Catholic faith to those who would otherwise be destined to an eternity in hell. And so this war on terror, you know, recasts and reframes these very old patterns that we've seen in history through a modern day form of psychological warfare.
That was Anthony J. Hall, author of the book Earth into Property, and he's also a professor over at the University of Alberta, Canada. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is rejoining me. Martin, what do you think about what he was saying there, particularly about the whole idea of a sort of fraudulent interpretation of 9/11? And he's saying that actually the police and the media are the real government. Parliament is just a soap opera.
Well, I think that's the reality. I mean, you do what you might call GCSE-level politics, where you learn about the separation of powers and the House of Commons and how the president's elected. And then there's the way real sausages are made behind the scenes, where the Nixon White House is running death squads in Central America and so are the Reagan White House and all the rest of it. There is a state within a state. That's absolutely clear. There shouldn't be, but there is. It's been there for a long time.
What about this term he was using there as well, the privatised terror economy? I remember Philip Agee, the former CIA guy, wrote several books back in, I think it was in the 1980s, talked about something called the warfare state. He was saying actually America as a country had become addicted to terror and war, and that the military-industrial complex, which Eisenhower warned us of, had become so powerful it was in fact an overarching influence through things like the Council on Foreign Relations.
Yes, and also not just terror in other countries, terror within their own country. So the bombing of Bologna Railway Station, I keep repeating this, in 1980 was carried out by the Western Intelligence Services.
That was in Italy,
it killed 86 people. Parliamentary inquiry uncovered the truth. It was carried out by SISMI, the Italian Secret Service, with the help of MI6 and the CIA. And the Dortmund Beer Hall massacre in the 1980s, the Brabant massacres in the supermarket massacres in Belgium, all carried out by the Western intelligence services on their own people in order to create fear, in order to create terror. And of course, 9/11 and 7/7 are simply continuations of the same policy. And it's all on the record. It's been on the record for years. That's the kind of thing they do.
But he talked about also about the Christian Zionists at the end there. That isn't some of the force which is that big in Britain, but it does explain to a certain extent how there is this kind of almost obsession about Israel, saying that Israel is there in the Bible and that therefore it's prophesied to be the great country which is going to do what God wants it to do. Now, this is a bit of a dangerous way to go, and it sounds a little bit like a kind of religious fundamentalism of its own, doesn't it?
It is, and of course the Islamic fundamentalism of Al-Qaeda is this mirror image of that, and of course both are being manipulated by the intelligence services. As Anthony Hall points out, who would have believed 30 years ago that we would have people pushing religious wars on us? But we are, and it's happening. It's like the 30 years war redux, isn't it?
But we actually had some what you might call good news this week, with the Barack Obama announcing that at least he's going to attempt to rein back US military spending, that he can only have one big war rather than two.
Spin. The US has got 700 military bases. They're militarily engaged in scores of countries which hardly ever get mentioned: Colombia, Somalia, Kenya. Basically, there is a huge, when Obama says we're going to withdraw, you know, we're going to reduce our military spending or whatever, I remember what Chief Joseph of the Nez Perce Indians said. They promised us many things. They promised us all sorts of things, but they only kept but one promise. They promised to take our land, and they took it. paleface speak with forked tongue, if we can call Obama paleface.
Okay, Martin, thanks very much. So who exactly are the Dark Forces? It's certainly clear that Yale University's Skull and Bones fraternity houses the most powerful people in America and is closely associated with the Council on Foreign Relations that we mentioned there, which is a private club rather like our own Chatham House in London that takes an enormous interest and is massively funded in foreign policy. In fact, to a certain many people would believe that organisations like Chatham House and the Council on Foreign Relations have a far greater influence on foreign policy than do the elected Foreign Office and the State Department in the United States. So let's have a listen now to Professor Anthony Sutton, who's written extensively on this organisation called Skull and Bones. He was a British academic based in US universities.
One member in particular left a memorandum. He wrote it in 1932. He was buried away in his papers. I don't think anybody found it before I did. And it was a six-page memorandum on the order, naming some of the members, and said it was the most sordid thing ever happened in the history of man. But to come back to my point, what are the objectives? In the words of one member, might is right. If you have the power, you use it to achieve your objectives. What is the objective? As you look at the histories of individual members, it can only be one thing: to acquire power, to keep power, to use power for their own purposes.
That was Professor Anthony Sutton speaking there. Martin, this sounds like a bit of a dodgy organisation, this Skull and Bones. Might is right. Is that the real philosophy of the West, do you think?
Well, pretty much you judge people by their actions, not their words, coming back to Obama's words of earlier on. Basically, most people have given up listening to Western politicians because they just don't believe a word they say. The fact is their actions speak much louder than their words.
Okay, so is there any light at the end of the tunnel with organisations like this Skull and Bones in the background?
Well, they're only a small part of the picture. The light at the end of the tunnel is that they're finally running out of road. Capitalism is in crisis. There's probably going to be a third world war. They are going to start it, and just like the last two, we are going to finish it.
Well, Martin Summers, Old Labour Oxford economist, thank you very much. That's all the serious talk out of the way, because after Rupert Murdoch's Sky News at 7, which we'll be actually skipping this evening, Friday night is music night. 2 hours live with Pat Hart and the Fresh Blood Party, who are limbering up right now. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Lib Dem councillor for Whitchurch Park and Bristol City Cabinet member for Transport, Tim Kent. Also to Old Labour Oxford economist, who you just heard there, Martin Summers. Next week, more taboo-breaking reports on Freemasonry, following the revelation that Jack Lopresti, the Conservative MP for Bradley Stoke and Filton, is a Freemason. This time looking back at Masonic corruption in local government, housing allocation and contracts, with a voice that's becoming familiar here. Investigative journalist and reporter for a six-part TV Granada TV series of the same name, Inside the Brotherhood, that's Martin Short. So, until then, if you're on broadband internet, you can hear all our previous Friday drive times, including this programme's five-point economic recovery plan, analysis of Easter's Tesco riots, a report on mobile phone masts and wireless safety, and evidence of Masonic corruption in the police, an investigation into leadership charity Common Purpose, as well as our inquiry into the 7/7 London bombings and 9/11 attacks on America. If you want to have a listen to this show and previous shows in our archive, go to thisweek.org.uk. You can also find this show on the BCFM website, which is bcfm.org.uk. So until next week, this is Tony Gosling wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend.